EcoReport is a weekly public affairs program
providing independent media coverage
of environmental and ecological studies
with a focus on local, state, and regional people, issues, and events
in order to foster open discussion
of human relationships with nature and the earth
and to encourage you to take personal responsibility for living sustainably in the world.
EcoReport is produced by an independent team of volunteers
working at the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
And financially supported by listeners like you.
Hi, and welcome to EcoReport. For WFHB, I'm Linda Leitner.
And I'm David Lyman. The Monroe County Plan Commission has changed the zoning ordinance to make proposed trash facilities a conditional use instead of a permitted use. The change is part of his county's response to a flood of complaints over Indiana Green Transfer and Recycling's proposal to put a waste transfer station on Bloomington's northwest side. Residents of western Monroe County have been pressuring county officials for months to take a stand against the proposal. In the Plan Commission's January 16th meeting, Monroe County Commissioner Julie Thomas said the change is an interim step designed to protect residents.
So getting public transparency and input into decision-making is what's missing now, and this fills that void until we can get the perfect or perfected or more perfect ordinances in place.
Thomas is the Monroe County Commissioner's appointee to the Plan Commission and serves as the Plan Commission's vice president. Planning Director Larry Wilson says currently the county code identifies two types of garbage facilities, central and remote. Each has a slightly different definition, which he says are vague and confusing. He says the changes approved are just a short-term fix. In the meeting, Wilson began by addressing remote garbage facilities.
Right now, remote garbage facilities are a conditional use already in ag, forest reserve, and conservation residential. This makes them a conditional use in limited business, general business, light industrial, heavy industrial, institutional, and mineral extraction, which means that in order to put one of these facilities in, you would need to go to the Board of Zoning Appeals, get a conditional use permit.
The amendment adds two new requirements. First, any permit applicant must now be reviewed by the county's Solid Waste Management Board to determine whether the facility is needed. If approved, the second requirement kicks in. Wilson says this second condition requires the applicant to have approval from Indiana Department of Environmental Management before filing with the County Planning Office for an improvement location permit. The amendment also makes central garbage facilities a conditional use in the three zoning areas they are currently allowed in. Wilson says this means applicants will have to get approval from the county zoning board.
And the primary reason is, again, why it may be totally appropriate use in some heavy industry, some institutional, and some mineral extraction, it may not be in all, based on the lack of infrastructure, services, roads, etc.
Wilson says the same additional requirements will also apply to central garbage facilities.
They would have to have a needs certificate from the Monroe County Solid Waste Board, and prior to applying for an improvement location permit, they would have to have all required permits from the Indiana Department of Environmental Management.
The amended language allows central or remote trash facilities in areas zoned light industrial. Speaking during public comment, about a dozen county residents said any trash facility should be prohibited in light industrial zones. Former Plan Commissioner member Scott Wells referred to the Indiana Greens proposed waste transfer station in his comments to the commission.
Let's talk quickly about the proposal that the West Side Transfer Station was about. You're talking about 200 tons a day of trash being proposed to be moved on that road, Angelina Road, 73,000 tons annually, which means 30 to 50 trucks daily moving on that road. When you read the definition, it says, for light industrial district, uses that have minimal exterior movement of vehicles and goods. So that's clearly a violation of your own definition there. But the key sentence in this, let me read it to you. Uses shall be restricted to activities that are not a nuisance because of dust, fumes, noise, odor, and refuse matter, smoke, vibration, water-carried waste, or other adverse effects of surrounding uses.
Commission member Tron Enright Randolph said, after hearing residents' concern over the proposed waste transfer station, making trash facilities a conditional use is not enough.
I keep hearing this volume of trash of 200 tons, and that should not be permitted in any light industry use. And this was my idea to make it conditional and to move that forward, and I thought that kind of addressed kind of a lot of issues, but I don't have any reassurance that we can really just be certain that when we write our new ordinance that we can avoid this issue again. And with that said, I won't be supporting it until we actually do kind of write in the light industry use.
The Plan Commission unanimously gave a favorable recommendation to forward the ordinance change to the Monroe County Commissioners. The County Commissioners also approved the ordinance change in their meeting last Wednesday.
Yesterday, the City of Chicago filed a lawsuit against U.S. Steel. The lawsuit alleges that the company violated the Clean Water Act by dumping hexavalent chromium into Lake Michigan. The chemical is known to be carcinogenic. The lawsuit names both of U.S. Steel's 27 spills as offenses. The first spill was in April and dumped 300 pounds of chromium into Lake Michigan. This threatened Chicago's drinking water and nearby beaches. The second spill was in October and dumped around 50 pounds of chromium into the lake. However, the U.S. Steel's report on the spill requested confidentiality. A press release from the Office of the Mayor stated, quote, Chicago did not receive any notification from U.S. Steel or any regulatory agency, unquote, about the October spill. Mayor Rahm Emanuel also cites the protection of drinking water as motivation for the lawsuit. The city is asking for both injunctive relief and civil penalties against U.S. Steel. Surfers near the U.S. Steel plant in Portage, Indiana, represented by the Surfrider Foundation, are also suing the plant, alleging that they're becoming ill from exposure to its chemical discharges. They also allege that the plant violated the Clean Water Act. Portage, a town on Lake Michigan, is also near the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. Some environmentalists place blame on the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, citing its lax enforcement of regulations.
On January 10th, New York City launched a two-pronged attack on the fossil fuel industry. It announced that the city will sell off billions of dollars in fossil fuel investments from its pension funds and file a lawsuit alleging that the top five oil companies contributed to global climate breakdown. The defendants in the city's federal lawsuit are BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Royal Dutch Shell. Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Royal Dutch Shell criticized New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio for the lawsuit immediately after the announcement. ConocoPhillips and BP were silent. Environmental activist Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, said the city's actions are, quote, one of the handful of most important developments, unquote, in the past 30 years. He continued, quote, the mightiest city on the planet has walked into a real fight with the richest and most irresponsible industry on the planet, unquote.
2017's average surface temperatures were 1.1 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, putting the world on course to breach the internationally agreed 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature barrier set by the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. However, as World Meteorological Association Secretary General Petteri Talas pointed out, temperatures tell only a small part of the story. The long-term temperature trend is far more important than the ranking of individual years, he explained. 17 of the 18 warmest years on record have all been during this century. The warming in the Arctic, which is heating up at least twice as fast as the rest of the planet, will have profound and long-lasting repercussions on sea levels and on weather patterns in other parts of the world. Talas said, noting that the warmth in 2017 was accompanied by extreme weather in many countries around the world. NOAA said earlier this month that weather and climate-related disasters cost a record $306 billion in 2017. The federal agency listed several noteworthy events, including the wildfires in the West, with total costs of $18 billion, tripling America's previous annual wildlife cost record. The year's hurricane season was also very expensive. Hurricane Harvey had total costs of $125 billion. Hurricanes Maria and Irma had total costs of $90 billion and $50 billion, respectively.
A recent study showed that 93% of store receipts contain the hormone disruptors BPA or BPs. Businesses use thermal paper containing these chemicals because they make receipts more stable and heat resistant, letting the paper run through receipt printers without catching fire. Both BPA and BPS, as hormone disruptors, interfere with the proper function of hormones, which allow cells and organs to communicate. Hormones are essential for metabolism, the reproductive and immune systems, and brain function and development. Both chemicals are absorbed through the skin and move directly into the bloodstream. BPAs and BPSs are so common that most people's bodies contain them, but people who handle receipts can have elevated levels. This study says that the greatest concern is the effect of repeated exposure on young children, pregnant women, and workers who handle thermal paper. For WFHB, I'm Linda Leitner.
And I'm David Lyman. We love to hear from our listeners. Contact us about stories we've aired, or if you have ideas for future stories, please send emails to earth@wfhb.org. And now it's time for Get Out and Hike, our segment showcasing the wonderful wild areas of southern Indiana and beyond.
This is Get Out and Hike, and I'm Jan Walker.
Hi, this is Kathy Meyer. I'm a naturalist at Monroe County Parks and Recreation, and I'd like to tell you about some of the more primitive trails at Flatwoods Park. Flatwoods Park is located just west of Ellettsville, about a mile off of Highway 46. You'll come to a parking area by playground shelters and restroom facilities, water in the spring, won't be on now. And from there you can access several trails. There is a trail system of posts with colored arrows designating the different trail loops. The whole park is about 200 acres, and it's about a mile from one end to the other. So if you like to get a little more walking in, but still be on pretty flat ground, you can come out here and get some exercise. In the winter, if there's snow, it's a great place to try out your cross-country skis, too, because you don't have any hills to go up and down. The trails mostly go around the edges of former agricultural fields. Before the county purchased this land for park use, it had been a hog farm, and there were corn and soybeans grown on several of the fields, and we've followed the edges of those fields to connect several of the trails. The Hoosier Hikers Council also constructed a trail for us a couple years ago that goes along the eastern property boundary and goes through a whole wooded area. This trail is very little used, but it's very interesting because it follows some little intermittent streams. It goes through a grove of old cedar trees. Several years ago, we had long-eared owls overwintering there that were found on the Christmas bird count. And then you can come out and come back on one of the other trails that follows the old fields and see all the birds that use the grassland areas out there. In winter, it's an especially good place to look for short-eared owls. We get reports every year of the short-eared owls coming out at dusk to hunt. And there's a good variety of sparrows and other birds there all year round, as well as other wildlife.
You mentioned some of the owls that used to be there in a bird count. Is there a website where they can go so people maybe could participate in these kind of things?
Well, for participating in bird counts, the best place to look locally would be the Sassafras Audubon Society website. We do have basic information about the park at the Monroe County Parks website, which is mcparksandrec.org. And you can find a map of the park and details about some of the facilities there.
In this week's feature, WFHB correspondent Norm Holey speaks with Larry Kaplan, horticulturist with Purdue University Extension, about white-tailed deer habitat and diet.
This is Norm Holey for WFHB, and today I'm interviewing Larry Kaplan, who is a horticultural specialist with the Purdue Extension program. He's located in Evansville. What I'd like to know would be more of the fundamental stuff, and that is, What is the diet of deer in Indiana? What do they do seasonally? Like in the spring, what do they concentrate on?
Well, deer are, of course, plant eaters, and they will feed on whatever is available to them at that particular season. In the early spring, they want to be gorging on anything freshly green. So in the landscape, that's going to be a lot of our blooming shrubs, our flowering perennials, bulbs, of course, anything we're putting out in the garden. All of that is just a treat for them after such a long, cold, vegetation-free winter.
Now, are they eating buds of redbud trees and stuff like that as well?
They'll eat buds. They'll nibble those right off. They graze down to the ground on a number of different bulb plants. They seem to love my wife's daylilies, for example. Other plants they don't particularly care for, and they'll avoid them unless there's nothing else for them to eat. And then they'll eat those because there's just nothing else.
They certainly love my tulips. So
Exactly.
do they eat morel mushrooms?
I don't know if a deer will eat mushrooms. Normally they're going after the greenery. It's possible that they may nibble on moss and other undergrowth like that, but I don't know if they would specifically target morels.
So then in the summer, what's their diet?
In the summer, they are going to be often seen out in farm fields, especially along the edges. They'll be mostly feeding on soybeans. Of course, they will keep coming into our vegetable gardens and into our landscapes. They're going to be usually more spread out because there's just food everywhere. But they're going to definitely try to be bulking up as much as they can during the summer months because that's when all the food's available.
And then in the fall, are they concentrating on nuts or?
In the fall, things are beginning to die down. They're going to be doing some last-minute chowing down of plants. Again, they'll probably be out in the farm fields for the most part. I've seen a lot of them chewing on soybean plants, so they may be going after the beans themselves at this point. And again, they're just trying to get in some last-minute protein, last-minute carbohydrates to get through the winter.
When we have a deer cull, what happens to the habitat? What recovers and what doesn't?
Well, any buds that get eaten are not going to be a big deal. The trees and the shrubs will sprout what we call adventitious buds. And these are buds that are not visible until they're needed, and they'll come straight out of the bark. So it's rare that they're going to totally kill trees or shrubs from deer browsing, although you could have a situation where all the flower buds have been eaten off. That's only important as far as, you know, landscapes go. In severe situations, though, deer have been known to strip the bark off of trees to eat that. And that could pretty much kill a tree. And those trees will not recover from that kind of feeding.
If Griffey, for example, has been overpopulated for several years while we've worked through, the city has worked through whether they were going to have a cull or not. So how long will it take for the vegetation to recover to a more natural state now that we've taken out 62 deer at Griffey?
I'm not a forester, so I really couldn't give you a specific on that. But I have seen cases where there has been overbrowse, and there could be a number of the smaller shrubs and the herbaceous forbs that just get completely removed due to overfeeding because you've got too many deer in too small an area. And in a lot of those situations, it takes years for those habitats to come back. And especially when you consider that there's so many invasive species like garlic mustard and the honeysuckles that will move right in because of this open area. So if that happens, it may never come back the way it used to be.
I lived in Pennsylvania for a number of years, and the woodlands of Pennsylvania are filled with garlic mustard. So I think it's probably from overgrazing, and then that's what fills in the space. Fortunately, we don't have that much here. But I've been in.
We have some, but it's not as big as in other areas where I've seen it.
So I would like to ask you about the weather. We've had a lot of cold weather, of course, to whether it's done anything to help cut back on tick or the emerald ash borer.
Mm-hmm. I do not expect any real major effect on the winter cold on most insect pests for this upcoming year. Yes, it's been cold, but we had a very long, gradual fall. The insects had plenty of time to get into their overwinter sites. Some of them overwinter in leaf litter, others underground, others inside the wood itself of a tree. We also had plenty of time for them basically what insects do is they produce a type of antifreeze in their blood. And so they can survive the winter cold without turning into an ice cube because of this. And we had plenty of time for them to do that before this cold spell hit. So I really don't expect a major effect at this point. It's been a very dry winter that may help with mosquitoes and possibly biting midges this spring, but that can all change depending on what the weather is a month from now.
For us city dwellers, do you have any recommendations you'd like to pass along today on preparing for the spring?
The main thing I've been getting questions on is pruning. I personally like to prune after the worst of the winter weather. So we're usually looking at February to do most of our pruning. And that way, if we have had some winter kill, you may be able to see it because the twigs will start shriveling up. They'll be turning black. And so you can prune those out while you're pruning out some of your other defects in trees and so forth. I had a friend who just called me. She did a lot of pruning about 3 weeks ago, and now we had this cold snap, and now she's seeing dead leaves on her boxwoods. So she's going to have to go back out there again after the winter and probably prune them a second time. And I just hate doing the same job twice. So I prefer to do most of my structural pruning in late winter while the leaves are still off, but the worst of the winter should be over.
Do you have any other comments you'd like to pass along to our listeners today?
No, I don't think I have anything else that they need to know about.
Are you an environmental activist, an expert on a particular issue of environmental concern, a concerned citizen interested in learning more about local and national environmental issues? EcoReport is seeking volunteer reporters to contribute short headline news stories as well as feature interviews. We provide all the technical training you'll need. Give us a call at 812-323-1200 or email us at earth@wfhb.org. That's earth@wfhb.org.
This is In Nature.
The chickadee is a common bird wintering in our woods, parks, and gardens. Its many adaptations allow it to survive our cold winters. Chickadees, tufted titmice, and nuthatches gather together to look for food and roost together to stay warm. They will also mob, gathering together to attack a much larger bird, thus chasing an enemy from their premises. Feathers are wonderful insulators, and additional feathers are added during their winter molt. When the birds preen, the oil spread on their feathers protects them from getting wet and chilly. Chickadees will use conifer trees and old nests as winter roosts, so leave old nests in your garden. They eat insect eggs and hibernating insects, including the larva of the goldenrod gall fly, which they easily extricate from the gall. They will eat the seeds in feeders and also those on plants left in gardens. However, the most important need for this bird and others in the winter is water. A heated bird bath would be welcomed. They forage all day in order to have the energy to last the night. During extremely cold winter nights, they can lower their body temperature up to 15 degrees. In this way, they can save energy by burning fewer calories.
You've been listening to In Nature.
And now for our weekly events calendar. Celebrate Lake Monroe's close relationship with Eagles at the Eagles Over Monroe event from Friday, January 26th to Sunday, January 28th, at the Four Winds Lakeside Inn and Marina. Bald eagles have thrived here since their reintroduction 30 years ago. This event dives into the lives of the eagles and other raptors. Tour the lake to see eagles in the wild, learn about recent research, and explore bird biology. Call ahead to register.
A tree talk will take place at Brown County State Park on Saturday, January 27th from 1 to 2 p.m. Meet at the Brown County State Park Nature Center for this in-depth look into the trees in the park. Legendary naturalist David Mao will lead the talk.
A winter wood walk will be held at Griffey Lake Nature Preserve on Saturday, January 27th from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Participants can hike the trails, look for animal tracks, and discover winter plant life. They will also learn strategies for cold weather survival, as well as tips for identifying tree species by the marks on the bark alone. Participants are advised to dress for the weather and wear comfortable shoes for this moderate hike. Register online.
Enjoy a solitude hike on Saturday, February 3rd from noon to 2 p.m. at the Cedars Preserve located on West Thrasher Road in Bloomington. Participants will be able to immerse themselves in the sights and sounds of the preserve without distraction. Join this hike to quietly explore the cedars with shared readings and inspirational quotes along the way. Call 812-336-5382 to participate.
A Goose Pond field trip is scheduled for Sunday, February 4th from 2:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Goose Pond Fish and Wildlife Area located at 13540 West County Road 400 South in Linton, Indiana. Join the Indiana Audubon Society for a sneak peek at spring during the special field trip. By this date in recent years, an abundance of waterfowl, cranes, and raptors can be seen in and around the thawing wetlands and ponds at this amazing property. Amy Kearns and Lee Sternberg will give the afternoon tours. Pre-registration is required. Call 765-827-5109 for more information. And that wraps up our show for this week. Eagle Report is brought to you in part by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
This week's news stories were written by Linda Green, Norm Holey, Wes Martin, and Andrew Brown. Norm Holey produced our feature, Jan Walker produced Get Out and Hike, and Cindy Bayou edited the segment.
Juliana Daly compiled our events calendar. Kirsten Payton is our engineer and audio editor. Producer and script editor is Rebecca Mueller. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For Eco Report, I'm David Lyman.
And I'm Linda Leitner. Join us on Thursdays at 11:30 a.m. before Democracy Now! And on Fridays at 5 p.m. before KiteLine for our weekly radio rundown of ecological news. You can access headline news and feature audio from our show anytime on the WFHB website.
You've been listening to the Eco Report,
a volunteer-powered production of Community Radio WFHB
in Bloomington, Indiana.
Available for download and podcast at news.wfhb.org.
Eco Report is your independent, ecologically inspired news source
for South Central Indiana.
Bringing you news that the Earth wants you to hear.
Send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas
directly to the Eco Report staff.
The email address is
earth@wfhb.org.
That's earth@wfhb.org.